Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. In this episode of Family Office Real Estate Insights, we speak with Robert Heyman of the Heyman Family Office on owning your own real estate assets within the family office. So today we have Robert Heyman with the Heyman family. And thank you so much for being here, Robert. I've been fortunate to get to know you a number of years by working for you and you know, seeing some of the great things that you've done currently and also in the past. So thanks for being on the Family Office Real Estate Insights.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, DJ.
Great. Well, the first thing that I want to do is I want to have you give a little background on your family, you know, where the initial wealth was created. And then I want to also go into yourself, because you've done something that is very, very rarely happens. And that is, you know, becoming a patriarch in your own right. So why don't you just take a couple minutes and first start off with, you know, the family's initial wealth.
Yeah, it really comes from my father, Fred Heyman. And it was a very interesting success story. Here's a guy who loved what he did, but also ran what I call a lifestyle business. And he ran a store called Giorgio Beverly Hills, which was on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. He was one of the first retailers on Rodeo Drive, helped form the Rodeo Drive Committee and all sorts of other quasi-governmental institutions that really helped form Rodeo Drive and the city of Beverly Hills and the Beverly Hills Triangle. I came home every day to a guy who was passionately engaged and saw it, and it was intoxicating, quite frankly. Giorgio Beverly Hills was a store that expanded many times and became, you know, it occupied half the block. And in 1983 or so, 84, they launched a fragrance called Giorgio Beverly Hills, which became the number one fragrance in the United States within a matter of a year or less, believe it or not. It was an exclusive distribution fragrance. And then within about 2 or 3 years, it became number one globally. After about, I'd say five or six years, that was sold to, ultimately became Procter & Gamble. But originally it was Avon. And then Avon sold it to Procter & Gamble. And then, you know, my father was invested in real estate and other things as well. I was very lucky to see him engaged. And after I left Giorgio, and I did work for him for a period of time, I started a business in the dental industry, which was for tooth whitening. It was called Discus Dental. And people usually know us by our, you know, key brands, which is Zoom and Bright Smile. And those two brands were our marquee products, especially Zoom. We had a dominant position in global whitening around the world. And it was a lot of fun. It was a great culture. We sold that to North American Phillips about 10, 12 years ago, their Sonicare division. And then I started investing in real estate and also in other alternative investments, as well as what everybody else does, stocks, bonds, et cetera.
Well, I'll tell you, what's interesting, you know, to me, and you're quite humble every time that you speak about yourself and your family. And, you know, after Georgia was sold, You know, you took a little time off, as I remember, and then you ended up with a couple of partners, but invested $45,000 into the business and grew it to $200 million a year in revenues in 100 countries. And, you know, to have a wealth creation of any significance in one generation is extraordinary, but to do it in a second fashion like yourself is absolutely amazing. And, you know, what's also interesting is, yeah, the real estate that we'll talk about here in a minute, but also, you know, now you're embarking on another opportunity, right? Still in the dental space, which with a company called Parametrics, and I'll let you briefly talk about that. But, you know, the one thing I've said since I started working for a family and with families about 7-8 years ago, I said, look, if I was sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars and I had to decide how to invest, I would find somebody that created their wealth in a specific area and literally say, can I invest with you? And that's exactly what your latest venture is. I mean, it's still in the dental field. You've got people that helped you before, you know, you have a great reputation and what seems to be a product that is not only definitely in demand, but it's cutting edge.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we are, I'm very involved in back in the dental industry, believe it or not. I didn't think I'd go back in so quickly, but I had a number of things that were offered to me in terms of, you know, positions, jobs, all sorts of consulting, you name it. And this one came across, which, like you said, I was planning on taking a little bit of time off, but it was so unique and so different in a truly disruptive technology using artificial intelligence and a whole host of other, really, it's a confluence, it's an orchestra of technologies to do something that's going to change the way dentistry is performed in many ways. So we've had great insights from numerous people who have been able to share their thoughts with us. And the fundraising efforts have been very successful, all of them. We just came back from the San Francisco MedTech meeting, and we were like the bells of the ball there. There were people lined up trying to get an audience with us. I felt like the Pope having somebody kiss my ring. But it was good. It was gratifying. Don't take it for granted at all. We're not done yet. There's a lot left to do. But it is very exciting, DJ. Thanks.
And my understanding, too, is, you know, 98% of the times you have a chipped, cracked tooth, you can't identify it. Usually, from my understanding, anyway, I say you have to wait till it really hurts to figure that out. And this, it can identify it, you know, immediately, and which is a huge benefit for not only the clients, but also the dentist, because there's additional revenue sources and everything from that, right? Did I pretty much summarize that pretty well?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, what we call damage, which is cracks in teeth. Yeah. And failing restorations being 60%+ of it, you know, that's really, it's groundbreaking. I mean, most people think that radiographs or x-rays identify cracks in teeth. They don't. It's mostly decay and some bone related issues. If you can see a crack in an x-ray, you're writhing in pain. But the interesting part is it's like dentistry's biggest dirty secret is it's 3 to 4 times more prevalent than decay, which is what x-rays do. And yet there's nothing that really identifies damage in teeth. So the incidence level is huge. It will become the number one diagnostic. 80% of patients are walking out of exams right now with damage that they just don't know about. So it's going to be a groundbreaker when we hit it. So very excited about it.
Which Thanks. Is great. Now I'm gonna regress a little bit here on the real estate because sure. I, you know, what you've done when I explain about the different types of family offices, you know, you have the families that created their wealth in real estate. You then have those that have a platform where they will, you know, hire institutional people similar to right in your backyard with Bill Gates. And then you have, you know, families that will acquire their own assets, manage their own assets, build up a portfolio, and then it's investing with operators, sponsors, as a LP, and then funds as a whole. So, you know, one of the outside of your, you know, one of the trophy assets, I guess you could say, for the family is where your father used to have his business, right? And that's right on Rodale Drive. And now who, oh man, my mind went blank. Who owns that building now, or who rents it?
Louis Vuitton.
Louis Vuitton, that's right.
It's one of their premier stores in the world.
That's right. And my only comment about that, if I remember right, is part of that lease, you negotiate enough of a percentage discount on buying anything there. But so when did you really start digging into real estate? Was this after the sale of Discus?
No, I started investing on my own and with friends and family and other people. It's been for a long time. I can't even pinpoint when. I'd say in the 80s I started, believe it or not. And then just kept adding to it. And I've never lost money in real estate. It's always been, you know, very positive. You're
that
right.
That was investing, but you weren't controlling those assets, correct? You were investing into deals?
Most of them I did not control. I invested with people who knew what they were doing, number one.
Yeah.
But I did make some investments on my own. But then once I had more purview over, you know, a liquidity event that I had, then we started investing, you know, wholeheartedly in commercial real estate, multifamily as well as office, and ultimately what became Biobank. By the way, I just want to straighten something out because obviously I come from Beverly Hills, which is where I was raised, and, you know, Beverly Hills brat and all that. Went to Beverly High, but I did move to the Seattle area. So when you said, you know, when you mentioned that earlier up in Washington, I'm no longer there. I just, the craziness of what's become California now. Unfortunate. I wish it would change. But
which is a
I said to somebody one time, I said, you'd have to be crazy to start a business in California. And said, well, why are you starting one here? I said, you're right. And I moved.
So you had the opportunity with that exit to still invest the way that you were, right? To invest with others. And instead of really building out and controlling all the various assets, why did you make that decision rather than being a little bit more passive?
When you invest on your own, you do have more risk in certain ways, I suppose, although I don't really feel it, but you can control what you're doing. You can call the shots, you can make decisions, some of which other people might not make the same way that you do. And there's a certain pride of ownership in everything that we do. And I don't think everybody quite has that same pride of ownership. So the ability to control, the ability to ultimately choose what we want to do in terms of if we need a liquidity event or not. We don't like to sell our properties. Most of our properties are forever holds. And that makes it very simple. But we did do a few syndications. Those are not forever holds, and those do. Even though we control them and we run them, and they've all overall, in spite of the pandemic, done well, they do need a liquidity event at some point. So I think going forward, it's we will participate with others. We will look at, you know, anything, but we prefer to do what we do the way we do it. Plus, also what we do is very unique, as you know, DJ. The Vibe Office concept is unique, and it's a cut above. It's better. It's a better way of work, and it's working.
So what were some, when you started getting going, what were some of the challenges that you initially experienced and obstacles coming out of the gate building this, you know, this platform?
I think starting out in the industry, I didn't have the deep bench of knowledge that a lot of people did. You know, Yardi to me, I'd heard of it, but I didn't know that much about it. CoStar, all the things that I take for granted, they're a regular part of my lexicon today. Never even heard of a lot of it. And, you know, how to design reports the way that we like reports, how to, you know, basically design the management team and incentivize people and, you know, doing what we do the way we do it. These are all things that evolved over time. And thank God. I mean, it's easy once you know it, but not so easy when you don't know it. And I'd say that's probably not unique to us, not unique to me, but now that we're there, it sure does make it a lot easier.
What was, if you could go back and say, all right, if I had known what I know now, when I was starting with probably a couple of the initial properties, that, you know, everybody has that moment that you sort of want to pull your hair out because you're like, okay, this is a little, there's a lot going on here. What would you say one of those things would be that now that you know, you would have done different?
We typically buy properties that are in high growth areas. It doesn't matter if it's a B property or an A property. We oftentimes do upgrade the properties. We rehabilitate them, especially if they're vibe. And the way that we do it versus how we did it earlier, learning that and seeing what was more important and what was less important and where you should pull the trigger first on the time frame of everything. It's all basically project management at the end of the day, isn't it? That's really changed quite a bit. We made a number of mistakes that I think if we had changed the way we were doing things, we would have probably done better. Not that we didn't do well, but done even better.
So, and you started initially in California with some of the properties, is that right?
We have some properties in California. We're currently not investing in California for obvious reasons.
But I mean, when you started, where did you first buy the first couple properties?
Years ago or more recently, since
you really started saying, I'm going to build this platform out, I'm going to build a portfolio.
In the beginning, we targeted multifamily, and it was really in Vegas, Salt Lake City area, Denver and Houston and Dallas. And we really got very lucky in Houston. We found quite a bit of value and we acquired a few thousand units there. And then over a period of about, you know, 5 or 6 years or maybe a little bit more, we sold the last one a couple of years ago, just before the pandemic. And so we're really not heavy into the multifamily business anymore, but we transitioned into vibe. And it was initially the cities that we were in are fast growth cities that are typically not first tier cities. They're usually second tier and in some cases third tier cities. So talk about Denver, Salt Lake City, Houston, Dallas, Austin, Texas, love Austin. Boise is a great city, albeit small, up here in the Seattle area. So these are the cities that are growing more quickly and doing better overall. And we find more value as well.
And, you know, with the studies that we do at the Institute, which we're starting our fifth year, actually, I think it's continued to come back that families like secondary markets, just like with what you're talking about. What about size of properties, total size? Did you really target and are you targeting now? Are you targeting the $30 million, the $10 million, the $100 million properties? Where would you say the average size is?
Well, in the office market, it's nice to have a certain size. That way we can do within our desired ecosystem and strategy what we would really like to do. And having said that, not as focused on size as we are on outcome and the ultimate ability to hold on to it for a very, very long time.
Got it. And so as part of, it seems like that this buy and hold strategy is, I would imagine that's part of your generational planning for your kids and their kids to be able to provide that cash flow as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The kids are right now, they're in college, they're in, you know, their last year of high school. And a big part of what we do is really transitional planning for down the road, years down the road. And I think that at some point, they're both going to need to learn what needs to be done, whether they manage it themselves, they decide to come into the family business. And it won't just be real estate. There are other things as well, other alternative investments. So it's a little bit more complex. But in terms of, let's just talk real estate right now. They're going to have to learn to analyze and make decisions and really live with it for a bit before they can do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I would say that their learning curve has yet to really begin, although they have come to the office with me on certain days and participated in various functions with the different silos.
Well, that's and you know, us being fortunate to have you on the board at the Family Office Real Estate Institute, that's one of our focuses, to provide younger gens with education so that can sort of help speed up that process or have a better understanding. And you know, and as we develop the institute, that's going to be, you know, more and more, and input from people like yourself are very important. I want to go back really briefly to when you started. When did you first start hiring somebody to help build out that portfolio? Was it initially? Was it a year, within 6 months, a year?
It was within a matter of months. I knew already before, and I wasn't, you know, I was doing okay before that. But the availability of, you know, a larger amount of funds made it possible to start bringing on the necessary people who would go and, you know, go out and find properties, who would vet the properties, who do due diligence on the properties, having a general counsel in-house so that we could operate quickly and protect ourselves in numerous ways. Obviously, the finance function, the marketing function, the design function, all these things. And as we get, again, Vibe was a big part of this. When we started Vibe, we saw how fast it was growing and how fast it could grow. We started really focusing our efforts on that and coming up with the lookbook and the strategic planning and all the other aspects that will help us going forward at some point.
So, looking back at the time, would you have done a different hire at the beginning as in a role and responsibility, or would you think you would have done the same way that you did it?
I would have done it a little bit differently, knowing what I know today. I guess that's one of those questions, isn't it? I think I would have brought on the due diligence and the search role, the property identifying and finding role. And I think I would have taken a little bit more of a regionalized approach for people who really knew what was in their backyard. That probably would have been a big aspect of it. We didn't start there. We started in a couple of other areas, but we backfilled it relatively quickly. We didn't wait too long. Within a matter of a couple of years, we had all of that. So, yeah, right. That's a good question.
What was the first step that you took? Like, was it to get somebody to help with acquisitions? Was it somebody to help just on the legal side? What was that first, you know, job that or position that you filled that you would have done differently, like you said, with more of the due diligence side?
Well, in the beginning, we had an acquisition, a gentleman who did acquisitions for us. He was like hybrid, kind of in-house, but kind of outside as well. And then we had another individual who helped us with vetting, and I went on the road a lot. And we found these properties, and, you know, it was a question of back then, this was after the Great Recession, right? And people were scared still. I mean, we kind of forget about it now, but remember how scary everybody was after that recession. And we picked up a half a dozen properties fairly quickly. And then we started transitioning a few years later as we picked up a few more.
You know, the talking about the analysis and everything, that's one of the parts that I've experienced that families don't necessarily, you know, there's a lot to it, you know. And one thing that I say is, you know, after you've been spending your whole life in one area, you know, whether it's perfume, whether it's dental, you know, there's still learning curves, whether it's hedge funds or venture capital or, you know, to some degree, right? And real estate is one of those. The good thing about real estate is that it's a pretty fundamental analysis that you can get an idea, you know, of what that opportunity is. And then you initially on financial, and then you move forward to the next step.
But there are a lot of pitfalls. There are a lot of pratfalls in real estate as well. You know, people who aren't experienced, people who don't know the ins and the outs, the ropes, property lines, demisements, property rights, taxes, upcoming taxes, all sorts of local political issues. You know, something as simple as buying an office property with a garage. Well, I mean, that garage can become a liability pretty quickly if it's not in good shape, and a whole host of other things. You know, all the operations of an office property, for instance, from the electrical, the lighting, the control units, the HVAC, on and on and on, elevators, they're all expensive. And if you're buying a B property because you think you're saving a few million dollars, but the elevators need real serious work. The HVAC systems have to be replaced. The lighting system's ancient. The interior has to be redone. It all adds up. And, I can see very easily how people make the mistake of thinking they're getting a bargain when in reality they just bought a really big liability.
Well, you bring up a lot of issues too, where, you know, a lot of families are very fee sensitive, but I don't think, everybody really understands, or a lot of families anyway, understand what it really takes and what's really involved. And you just named a few of them. And, it definitely can have an impact on returns. And there's a lot more work to it than just, I'm going to invest the money and let the thing go.
And at the end of the day, you got to fill it up, right? And people just don't come knocking a path to your door saying, hey, I want to lease, office space from you, for instance. And so how you're going to make the property appealing, and what are you offering exactly? Where is the property? What's the best, most logical and appealing way of essentially dressing it for the market and positioning it? So it looks simple, but there's a lot of aspects to it that have to be made the right way.
You know, one of the things, I'm a huge believer, and we obviously talked about this in great detail. I'm a huge believer in brand. And on many aspects, one is, and in real estate, it can give you greater value when you sell, but it also helps to fill that building. And when we started working together and I was working for you, one of the things that you talked about is you spend so much time in the office, and you need to have a place that you feel really good to go to, like a home type of a deal. And, that ended up expanding into this vibe concept, which has been doing very well, right? Even with the downturn of what's been happening. Why don't you touch a little bit about this concept? Because I'll tell you, it's one of the, I believe it was the first boutique office brand concept out there. And I think that what you've built and what it is has really dictated or shows how powerful a brand can be and the benefits it can bring.
Yeah, it's a branded boutique office concept. I think there are other office concepts out there who they consider themselves boutiques, and that's probably very true, and it's good. This is a branded concept. We think it's a better way to work. It has, within the ecosystem, there's co-working in some cases, and we're expanding that. There are different floors with different amenities. It's amenity rich, typically. It has a different type of feel. And, during the pandemic, we had the same issues everybody else had. It had nothing to do with how beautiful your property was. It had to do with, let's get out of the office as quickly as possible and not get sick. Because if you'll recall in the beginning, nobody knew what the hell was going on, right? Biggest problem is you couldn't buy any toilet paper. Over a period of time, it started to ameliorate. And then it got to the point where we realized that we were, in spite of the pandemic, in spite of certain types of tenants not coming back, we were filling up our properties when no one else was. It seemed like almost nobody else was. And we're hearing that from the brokers today. Our properties are the ones that are getting filled up, and it's a real feather in the cap for the brokers. It's a real feather in the cap for the team, but I think also to the concept of what we're doing and the work that we put into it. It's overall done quite well.
So, I've got one more question for the most part before we finish up here. If you've got if there's a family, that's listening to this right now, they had an exit, they sold their business, and they're like, yeah, we've got some real estate investments similar to what you said. And they're trying to make that decision to either just be passive, invest with operators, invest in funds, or to build out their own platform like what you did, where you own the portfolio properties and you have that control. What insight would you give to somebody listening right now?
Somebody experienced or somebody not experienced?
Nope, not experienced.
I would say go work with somebody else in the beginning, or hire people who can give you their experience until you have your own, because you can make some very big and very expensive mistakes in commercial real estate, and it's easy to do. And trust me, we've made some. I would say also that, you know, the debt levels, keep them low. Don't get leveraged up. We've never taken on second tier debt. We like to think that our properties are low leverage, which, you know, crazy times like right now where, you know, lo and behold, we have inflation after how many years, and the interest rates are high and banks hate office properties. They don't look at you as different. It's all vanilla. And so thank God we're in good shape. We're able to ride this thing through, and if we have to refi something, we can do it. But if you have a, you know, certain of these properties, you got a B property, two or three of them, in fact, and you're not filled up, and you have you had decent leverage before, today it's not just decent, it's very high leverage. Banks aren't coming to you and saying, we're going to give you an extra $2 million. They're saying, we'd like to know if you can give us $2 million. You know, that's a sea change from the way it was just a few years ago. And so I think it just pays to be conservative. And remember that all this stuff rides out over the long term. I think that even office properties are going to come back full swing in a different way. And that's one of the, you know, one of the things we talk about all the time. You and I have spoken about it as well. This work from home and this pandemic, post-pandemic world, what's going to happen. I think that, you know, I think office properties have a very real reason for being. And I think they're going to get better than ever. This is going to force us all to get better. And it is forcing us all to get better. So I think that over a period of time, those people who can acquire assets in a market like this, or, you know, if it continues to shift downward, then at some point, it's going to be a very handsome payday down the road.
Robert, thank you so much for your time, which is always greatly appreciated. And
thank you,
DJ. Your insight and experience to share. And, you know, we'll be talking again soon, and good luck on your, you know, continuing the brand that you're building in the office sector and also Parametrics.
Waiting for FDA approval, and then we're good to go. Thank you, DJ.
All right. Take care.
Good to see you. Bye-bye.